This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 131.
So we take off some time in January and go sit on the beach in California and do some reflection as well as work. This year, my reflection was Michelangelo. Why? Michelangelo was a gifted human being. But when you looked at his life, he was early on a sculptor, incredible sculptor. He was a painter of the Sistine Chapel. He was a poet. At age 70, he reinvented himself. The Pope came to him and said, rebuild St. Peter's. This is not about religion. This is about an individual who said, I am going to continue to say the best is yet to come. So at an age when most people would be retired and sitting on the beach forever, he's saying, where can I take my talents and my passion and continue to invest? I'm going to fail retirement because I don't want to retire. I want to continue to reinvent. That was my mentor. My long ago 500-year-old mentor was saying, you won't be Michelangelo, but can you find a way to create variance in your life, solve problems other people don't see, and keep doing that? I mean, the same passion you had as a 23-year-old.
How do you get certain in an uncertain world? Why is seeking out variance in your life the key to personal and professional growth? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. If you've been following the podcast, then you know that last October, I launched a targeted 3-week virtual development experience for next-gen HR leaders called Elevate. Over 100 next-gen HR leaders participated in Elevate and had the opportunity to learn directly from some of the best minds in our field. In fact, one participant said that Elevate is like a master's degree in HR at a fraction of the cost. If you're serious about becoming a more business-focused and strategic HR professional, this is a must-attend event. And the good news is that Elevate is back and will take place over 3 weeks, starting on Tuesday, May 20th. And over those 3 weeks, you'll have the opportunity to learn from 18 thought leaders during 16 interactive sessions with live Q&A in every session. And every session is also designed with the goal of helping you to take your business acumen, strategic thinking, influence, and coaching capabilities to the next level. And headlining Elevate 2025 is this week's guest, Dave Ulrich, who'll be talking about the next agenda for human resources, but you're also gonna get to learn from executive coach extraordinaire, Muriel Wilkins, talking about how to break through your beliefs that hold back your potential, talent guru Mark Efron on why your organization needs a talent philosophy, agile HR expert Rena Hellstrom talking about how you do agile HR and where you get started, Vicky Zhao sharing actionable frameworks to help you communicate like an executive, and even a session from two AI experts on how to do AI-driven process redesign for HR leaders. You can register for Elevate now. And through March 20th is super early bird pricing, where you can save up to 30% off the regular price. Now, don't miss out. Go to www.elevate2025.vip/nextgenhr. That's www.elevate2025.vip/nextgenhr. Or go to futureofhr.com and you can learn more about the 16 interactive sessions, the 18 thought leaders, and why this is the development experience of the year for next-gen HR leaders like yourself. And with that, I'm excited to introduce this week's guest, the one and only Dave Ulrich. Many of you know Dave as the father of modern HR, whose groundbreaking work has had an immeasurable impact on the field. Dave has been ranked as the number one management guru by Business Week, profiled by Fast Company as one of the world's top 10 creative people in business, a top 5 coach in Forbes, and recognized on Thinkers 50 as one of the world's leading business thinkers. Over his career, he has published over 200 articles and book chapters and written over 30 books. His ideas have shaped how people and organizations deliver value to customers, investors, and our communities. But today, we're going to go beyond Dave's many accomplishments to truly get to know him better as a person. That's right. In this conversation, we get up close and personal with Dave to understand more about his upbringing, his personal journey, and the values that have shaped his thinking over his career. It was truly an honor to be able to have this conversation with Dave, and I wanted to thank him again for being so candid, open, and authentic with all of us. I know you will enjoy this special conversation with Dave as we discussed how his parents' values shaped his view that work's an opportunity, not a burden. Why a pivotal college course redirected him from law to a groundbreaking career in HR. The importance of building on existing knowledge rather than reinventing HR concepts. His personal motto, the best is yet to come, and how it drives continuous learning for him. And why embracing variance and thinking leads to personal growth and innovation and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode. And as you listen, please drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with the one and only Dave Ulrich. Dave, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. It is great to have you back.
JP, I can't think of a conversation or a topic I'd rather talk about. What a great time.
We're excited to have you back. And in our conversation today, now we've had you on three times. The first time I crowdsourced the questions off LinkedIn. So I didn't ask JP's questions. I asked questions from the audience, and I think it was terrific. One thing that people should know about Dave is that he does not like questions in advance. So most of my guests, I do send the questions out in advance. I want them to be prepared. Dave says, no way. And why, Dave? Because if we met in a coffee shop in Dallas, we wouldn't have questions, right? We would just talk. And so today's going to be a very open conversation. And so the first question I've got for you, Dave, is you were considered the father of modern HR, but I'm curious, what was young Dave Ulrich like? What early experiences shaped your perspectives on life, leadership, and organizations?
It's fun to go back and try to figure out what drove what, and I don't know for sure. Obviously, parents, I had two parents who were very good. My dad believed I should work. When I was 13, we knew a guy who owned a gas station where I lived. My dad went to him and said, I will pay Dave's salary. You hire him to go work in your gas station at 13. So I worked in the gas station. And then my dad said, that's not enough. You need to learn to work. I put up little ads everywhere. I'll do yard work. I still remember decades ago, I was 14 or 15, doing yard work that probably you did when you were young, mowing a lawn, pulling weeds. And it was a big house where we lived. And I looked in the window and there was some kid my age watching me. And I thought, this doesn't seem right. But in the end, that's a passion. You work, you care, you give back. My mom cooked more casseroles for people in need in the neighborhood than any human being in the world. My dad worked for the government. He said, I'm a public servant and I need to instill that service within you. I think I got an ethos for work. I'll translate that real quick because I don't want to bore anybody. Look at my history. Went to college, don't have a family heritage of great academics. The goal is to get a degree. So I took 21 hours a semester, kind of compulsive. And every semester I had to go see the provost of the university and they said, you're supposed to take 16. I said, I'm taking 24 this semester. What's your grade point? I told him, he said, okay. So I graduated in five semesters. I've always had that kind of an engine that just keeps on going. Those are stories I don't tell very often.
It's great to hear that. I think it's not surprising you have that kind of work ethic, but I love that your dad said, I'll pay his salary. Just go put him to work. I think more of us need that.
Yeah. I've tried that with our kids. I'll pay their salary. You make them work and get used to it. I mean, work is not a curse. It's not a four-letter word. It's an opportunity. What about you? What drove your early experiences? This is a conversation.
For me, my mom was a marriage and family counselor. And my dad was an entrepreneur, but also had a PhD in economics. He was like a renaissance man. He did a lot of different things. But the last thing he did was he ran a bubblegum machine business where he actually built the machines himself and put them out. And so when I was 15 years old, about to try to get a car, my dad said, look, you can go get a job like everyone else, or I will give you four gumball machines and I'll teach you how to locate and you can go out and put out your own machines and make your own money. I said, that sounds like a better deal because they made money while you slept. I went out and did that. And he taught me how to locate gum machines. And I'd walk into a pizza place or a small business and say, hey, I'll give you 25% of whatever this gumball machine does. Just going to sit here real pretty. It takes up about a foot of space, blah, blah, blah. And we would do that all day. And my dad taught me that sales is all about, not really about making the sale. It's about the first one and the last one, because everything's practice in between. So we'd spend all day. And I would go out there at 15 years old and try to sell gumball machines. It made an impact on me. It changed me. So
I love it. When we meet in person, I'm going to go find some gumballs. I got one other story about my dad, since you opened that window. He worked for the government, built campgrounds for a large part time, then worked for a group called Job Corps in the 60s and 70s, which was a social agency. Then he retired pretty early. And he decided that the commitment to service was real. So he would go to stores and take their day-old food, the fruit, the bread that's still good, and give it to shelters around the city. And he called it his bread run. So for 25 years, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, Dad did a bread run. And every time I'd go visit, he'd say, Dave, we're going to go do the bread run. I go, oh, here we go again. But I learned by example, not by word. You go, when he died, no, I'm going to get emotional. I hadn't planned that. Thank you for really pulling out some old memories. The hall where we held the service was full to the rafters with people who got food from my dad doing his daily bread run. I find that's kind of an interesting message to say, you give back without fanfare. This wasn't a big fanfare. It wasn't a big deal, but we hauled day-old food into all kinds of shelters and places that people needed it. And I think Dad led by example. I hope I do that also with those I work with.
It's an amazing story, Dave. I was getting goosebumps as you talked through there. And I think it's so clear to me, and probably everyone who's listening, how you give back. You're so generous. I mean, not only do you respond, people may only know you from like LinkedIn now, because now we can deal a little closer to people with like LinkedIn, but you respond to every comment on LinkedIn almost uniformly, almost to the point that we think there's a chat GPT Dave AI agent. It's not, it's Dave Ulrich.
It's me.
You know, and I know that. And I've met you, I've talked to you. I mean, you give back to this field for so long, and we're so grateful. And now we know why, because of your dad's great bread runs.
Yeah. And thank you for letting me think of that memory. If I could, I'd show you my dad next to his truck, dressed bad, very down to earth. He got a college degree in forestry with the lowest grade point average in the history of the university. Academics wasn't his thing, but he served. And so did my mom. I'm grateful for that legacy. And I hope we lead by example. We lead by example more than rhetoric. And I hope people see that in you. You're an entrepreneur. I hope if you have children, I hope they have their gumball machines or whatever the equivalent is today. And I hope we foster the next generation.
Absolutely. And it's a great story. And that's what it's all about. We all want to give back, and we want to see the world a better place, and we want to have an impact. Especially most people went to HR. We are trying to do good things. That's typically our motive. But I'm curious, if you hadn't followed this career path as an academic, author, consultant, I'm not even sure how to really categorize your career. But if, let's say, you just couldn't do that, what career would you have chosen or went into?
Great question. I had planned to go to law school. I actually enjoy some of the discipline and rigor, and law was fun. Again, we're telling stories. What career would I got into? Probably law was the plan. Now looking back, I probably, once in a while, we make money and we invest. I'm not a good investor, except my wife's father got us into real estate. You talk about making money while you sleep. Real estate is a great place. He was in California, so he let us say, would you guys like to have 5% of this building? And we're going, yeah, we'll take that. So we've done some of that, which has been a great way to do things. I like careers where I learn, get to give back. My sister is a teacher, so that would have been where I go. But I was on my way to law school, took a course in organizational behavior long time ago, decades ago. And the professor came in and he said, he became a mentor. I don't have anything assigned. I'm going to give a class 2 days a week for an hour and a half. And you show me what you learned about organizations. Look at where you live, where you work, where you worship, where you play. Everything you do is brought to you by an organization. It's actually an interesting exercise. Everything you see, the microphone you have, the glasses you're wearing, the shirt, there's an organization that created that. Everything, the books in my background, the pictures on the wall, the chair, what makes those work? He triggered me to write papers. What do I see in the organization where I work? What do I see in the organization where I live? And I ended up writing a 10-page paper every week for him. And I cheated. So I'm going to make my confession. The reason I did 21 hours, I was an English major. So I'd write a paper on the sources of power in Paradise Lost, Shakespeare's vision in King Lear. And I turned it into English. This is cheating. And I turned it into him. My English professor said, that's wacko. Beowulf, an old story in English, the ideal organization, man, exists today. And my professor in OB said, keep writing this stuff. It's crap, but it's really thoughtful. You know, you're trained. And at the end, he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to law school. And he said, you got to be kidding me. Come explore organizations. So I called my parents, and I'll end this story quickly. Mom and Dad, I'm not going to go to law school. I'm going to go study OB. And they said, obstetrician, you're going to be a doctor. And I said, no, OB is this field called organizational behavior. And they said, what is it? And I said, I have no clue. I have no clue, but I'm going to take another course and another. Ended up doing graduate work and writing. And I still have that desire. My wife, and I've shared this before, is a very good psychologist. She says I have OCD, which is organization compulsive disorder. Everywhere I go, I tend to reorganize organizations. I'm horrible to go to dinner with. Because I go to dinner and I look at the couple we're with. We had dinner recently with a couple. And I say, you know, this organization, this restaurant is about 10% less efficient than it should be. Would it be okay if I talk to the manager? And they look at Wendy, my wife, and she says, Dave, take it easy. Your OCD needs to slow them down. This is what I like. I don't know about you, but I like to look at organizations. I like to look at how they work and how they shape and how they drive people. So that leads to research. It leads to a whole bunch of stuff. But that's kind of a lens into my world. I'd be a lousy dinner companion.
I'll buy you dinner anytime. But I think that's that engine in you that drives, right? Because I think people don't always understand why some people are so successful. There is something inside us that just keeps us moving. We can go back to why or trying to please our parents. Who knows? I love you have that engine, and I think we're grateful because when you went in the field of OB, I went many years later, but you really helped set the field up. I mean, you helped develop and build out what that field is, especially on HR. And so I think it's amazing. One of my other favorite things about you, Dave, is that one of your favorite sayings and how you like to end a lot of your presentations is by saying, the best is yet to come. Tell us more about why you say this and what it means to you.
I read a lot of people's stuff, and often I see people recycling. I don't know if you're finding that as you get older. We're going to do inclusion. And I go, you know, we used to call it participative management. There's a literature out there, and I'm not opposed to inclusion, but build on what's been done. In fact, I went back about 6 months ago, and I reread Management the Worker by Roethlisberger and Dixon, the old initial Hawthorne studies. That was a darn good study. And I reread McGregor, Theory X, Theory Y. I reread some of Drucker, and I think our job is to not recycle stuff. And I think we see some recycling in our field. Let's come up with new terms for the same old stuff. But it's to spiral forward. What's new? So if I'm a 30-year-old person going into HR because I feel that call, whatever that call is, I'd encourage you to find out what's been done so that you're not trying to reinvent, because there are great thinkers and your kind. You talk about all those you've interviewed. Bob Eichinger. Bob was such a mentor to me and has been. Linda Gratton. I mean, you just go on. There's so many good thinkers. And then say to yourself, what do I add on top of that? What do I see that might build on their work? So I'm not criticizing. And I think it's that reinvention and reimagining is always fun. And I'll share another much more. We've gone from college to today. I'm getting older. There's an insight. I see pictures of my younger brother all over. I don't know if you ever see pictures of your younger brother. That's you. So we take off some time in January and go sit on the beach in California and do some reflection as well as work. This year, my reflection was Michelangelo. Why? Michelangelo was a gifted, gifted human being. But when you looked at his life, he was early on a sculptor, incredible sculptor. He was a painter of the Sistine Chapel. He was a poet. At age 70, he reinvented himself. The Pope came to him and said, rebuild St. Peter's. This is not about religion. This is about an individual who said, I am going to continue to say the best is yet to come. So at an age when most people would be retired and sitting on the beach forever, he's saying, where can I take my talents and my passion and continue to invest? It's not easy to find people like that. Peter Drucker did it until he was in his late 80s. I saw Peter Drucker speak when he was aged. You've seen it with some of the leaders in firms where you've worked. And I think, to me, that's kind of more exciting than saying, well, I'm going to go do a cruise, or I'm going to go, no offense to anyone who does cruise, or I'm going to work on my golf game, or I'm going to go whatever. I'm going to fail retirement because I don't want to retire. I want to continue to reinvent. That was my mentor. My long ago 500-year-old mentor was saying, you won't be Michelangelo, but can you find a way to create variance in your life, solve problems other people don't see, and keep doing that? I mean, the same passion you had as a 23-year-old.
Hey there. After a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Dave. Hey there, I'm excited to announce an amazing resource for next-gen HR leaders that has been 2 years in the making. After conducting over 100 interviews over the last 2 years with the top minds in our field, I have put all the best advice into what I call the HR Leaders Blueprint, career acceleration strategies from 100-plus industry thought leaders. The HR Leaders Blueprint is completely free and filled with 18 pages of real-world advice from over 100 HR thought leaders. This guide delivers exactly what you need to know about building influence, driving business results, and accelerating your HR career. And just like the Future of HR podcast, the HR Leaders Blueprint is filled with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to help take your career and impact to the next level. To download the HR Leaders Blueprint, go to futureofhr.com. That's futureofhr.com. And the best part is that after you download the HR Leaders Blueprint, you'll also be subscribed to the Future of HR newsletter, which means you'll be joining an exclusive community of next-gen HR leaders who want to accelerate their career and elevate their business impact. And the Future of HR newsletter is the only newsletter written for next-gen HR leaders like you. Think of it as your weekly HR leadership booster shot, quick, powerful, and designed to help you put the ideas into practice immediately. So what are you waiting for? Go to futureofhr.com and download the HR Leaders Blueprint and get a jump start on your 2025 career goals today. Well, I think the best is yet to come for you as well, Dave. I mean, you continue to make just a lot of impact on the field, and it's impressive. And I think I do agree. We do a lot of recycling, and I think it's okay in some ways because it's what happens naturally. But if we don't understand the foundation and the shoulders we're standing on and the theoretical implications for this, we are doing a disservice to the field. So I agree with that. I think it's about, there may be some new words and there's new context of happening, but to not go back and say, well, how do people really learn? What do people really want out of work? What are the basic human needs underlying all of this? What's that so that, right, as you always say, has impact. So I think we've got a lot of work to do there. And that's part of the podcast for me. It's been a mission of, hey, don't forget all this great work. Truthfully, and this is a plug for the podcast, go read Bob Eichinger's book, The Leadership Machine. Just read that one book and you will know more than most talent people who are sitting in that role today. Read it, maybe read three times. It's dense. It takes a long time to read that book. I just reread it. Go read books in the 1980s. Go read Drucker and you're going to see, wow, there are a lot of the same concepts to your point. And we sort of forget. As humans, we have a very short-term memory, which is unfortunate at times. So you built a big legacy, though. So I appreciate
that. I mean, one
of
my favorite books with Bob, and I adore Bob. I mean, I just adore Bob because he's a curmudgeon and he's a thinker. And I have a copy somewhere. Nobody's read it. So I can say, go got it, because nobody's read it. 100 things you should know. And so we went through the field and said, there's 100 things you should know. And then we did another one, 50 more things you should know. And our field sometimes doesn't do that. It just doesn't do that. If I'm going to go into HR, be serious about it. Go read some things. Go learn some things. And the beauty today is you can do that pretty quickly with AI. You can summarize it. You don't have to read the 400-page Management the Worker by Roethlisberger and Dixon. You can get a summary that captures the message. But there's still some great research out there that I think we build on. And you've seen it in the companies where you've worked and the guests you've had.
It's great. And let's talk a little bit about this because I think you have a legacy in this field. A legacy in HR. And I wonder, what do you hope people will say about you and your contributions to the field 50 years from now?
I hope we're still here as an earth 50 years from now. But in COVID, and I'll try to answer that in a story. COVID changed my life professionally. It changed many people. I was traveling. Somebody said, I had the dinner yesterday. They got me off the restaurant manager. So they asked me, so what have you done? I traveled. I was traveling 250 flights a year. For 20 years, just on the road, traveling, trying to observe, trying to learn. And COVID hits, you're not traveling. And then they started doing podcasts. And people have always said to me, Dave, you have a face for radio. Don't do those things. And podcasts were hard. I didn't do it. And so I sat down. And I said, what am I going to do? Finally, in a world of uncertainty, here's the headline. In a world of uncertainty, when you don't know what's going to happen next, the best is still yet to come. What are you certain about? Let me say that again. In a world of uncertainty, what are you certain about? What is that core value? Who are you certain you'll have with you? What are you grateful for? And it hit me. I'm certain about two things, and everybody's going to be different. It would be fun to know. So what is JP certain about? because you don't know what's going to happen. This next gen HR thing may work. It may not work. Where am I going to live? Where am I going to work? I came up with two. I want to learn. So when COVID happened, I'm not going to be traveling doing in-person talks. I'm going to be doing them virtually. I'm going to do webinars. I'm going to try to learn how to do that. And number two, I'm going to learn things that will help others get better. And I go, for me, Dave Ulrich, those two standards become really helpful. At the end of the day, did I learn anything? And did what I learn help others get better because of what I learned? I take obscene notes every day. Every week I fill out a legal pad, things I learned in our conversation. Here's some things you taught me already in our pre-work. Here's some things I'm going to continue to think about. And to me, that's the certainty in the uncertainty. I don't know if I'm going to travel. I think I know I'll travel the next week, but I don't know what's going to happen in 2 years. I don't know what my health's going to be. We get older, our health goes bad. I don't know a lot of things, but I know some things I'm certain about. So I would really advise, I wish I'd have gotten that earlier, the managers, the directors, the future leaders of HR, who we all care about. What are you certain? What are you certain? Both personally, and that was my personal certainty, and I have professional certainties of things I'm, my North Star, Steve Covey's words, but I hope we have those. If I were to ask you, and I've given you time to reflect a little bit, what's JP certain about? No matter what.
Professionally, yeah. I am certain that I want to give back and add value to the field. Nice. That's it. I mean, that's what for me has always been, and doing things that people have not done before is something I've always tried to push myself to do, to not be put in a box. When I was young, I was playing, quick story, side note for me, when I was eighth grade going into ninth grade to play football, I benched 225 and I squatted 350, which now at my age, no way in a million years could I do that. So I was like lifting weights a lot. And I started to play football and I was okay. And I made freshman year and I basically was like getting pulled up to go to varsity the second year, but I've been like the fourth string linebacker. But I went to camp in the summer of my sophomore year and everyone had gotten bigger, meaner, faster. And everyone's like, hey, you're a football guy. You're a football guy. And I just said, no, I don't get to be typecast. And I quit. I said, I'm going to go do something else. And I went and played tennis and I did other stuff leadership wise. And so for me, it's like the certainty is defining your own future is the key, but it's all about giving back and having impact. And so I was like the president of the Key Club. I did other things that I thought was more about other people versus just about me all the time. And so those are probably the professional certainties, but that's a tough question. I'm going to have to think a little bit more about it.
I love the professional one. I'm just going to tie into that. Michelangelo is one of the world's great sculptors in his early years. Then he's Sistine Chapel in his 30s, then poet. And then he goes, I'm going to go create variants. I don't know how to do architecture, but I've been asked to redesign St. Peter's. And then the churches in the Catholic Church have often been designed using his templates in his mind. I think sometimes as we age, and I'm going to write about this week, I write on LinkedIn every week and I try to think, what am I going to write about? As we age, we reduce variance. We try to mitigate risk. We try to get narrower and narrower. One of the things I would encourage myself and others to do is to increase variance. Put yourself in a new situation. I played football for 2 or 3 years. I knew how to lift weights. I'm going to go try tennis. It's going to be variance. And I'm not going to be great at the first, probably. You may have been great right off. But the variance and the certainty is I'm going to learn. I'm going to improve. I'm going to try to get better. I really love that idea of encouraging those who come into our field to go find variance, go find stuff that's out of the comfort zone. I worked with business leaders once and they were in a company and I said, I'm going to give you an exercise. They said, what's that? Go to Walmart. Now, I don't mean to slam Walmart at all, but these are multimillion dollar executives. I've never been to a Walmart. That's a problem. I'm not going to go ask you to shop. But you go spend an hour at Walmart, come back. What did you learn? Variance. Get out of your comfort zone. And they came back and said, wow, just learn to see things that other people may not see.
I think that's an amazing takeaway from the conversation already, Dave. I love the idea of getting certain in an uncertain world. And then this idea of variance as a way to grow. So yes, write about that on LinkedIn. I can't wait to see that come out. I'll be very excited.
Well, and here's the start. We do a survey. Everybody does surveys. You've done surveys. We've all done surveys. Which of these HR practices matter the most? They both get a 3. Oh, it's an interesting meme. Look beyond it. The A says 3, 3, 3, 3, 3 with 5 respondents. B says 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now everybody can do the math. They're both 3. They are very different. The first one says there's a standard process that's not going to differentiate you. The second one says 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's still 3. The mean is a mean thing. Now you're getting my lines in LinkedIn. you want to be the five that others will copy. And I hope in HR, we're not trying to do what others do. We're trying to differentiate. We're trying to get in a field. And for me, and professionally, and you may or may not want to go there. For example, I am committed to delivering stakeholder value. That is a passion, value added. You use the word value. And here's my insight. The human and human resources is not just the employee. It's an interesting play on words from somebody who studied English. The human is any human being who interacts with the company should get value from the interaction. The employee, no question. It should be a great place to work. You should thrive. You should flourish. You should have well-being, whatever the latest incantation is. Customers are people. Are we using HR to drive customers? Investors are people. Citizens are people. I could go a little longer on this if you'll give me license. I think our field of HR has been focused, and they say, this is really good strategic HR. We deliver financial results. So Mark Huslid and Jack Fitzens and brilliant, brilliant colleagues, smarter than me, David Green and others whom you worked with. Let's invest in HR practices and show the impact on ROI, growth, revenue, profitability. Here's the aha. Every financial result is a lag indicator. What were your results last quarter, last month, last year? So we've been teaching HR people to be a lead indicator of lag results. Well, that's not where I want to go. So what drives financial results? And it's pretty simple. Customers. If the customer doesn't buy your product, the financial results are crap. That's technical. If a customer does buy your product, the financial results will follow. And investors who look at efficiency. So I've been making an argument. The stakeholders of HR are any human being, a customer, an employee, a business executive, a board director, who engages with my company. And the ones I want to influence the most are the outside customers. Because if I can influence them to buy more product, that's going to show up in the financial results. I don't want to be the HR practices that got me results last year. I want to be the HR work that will create results next year with customers, with investors. And so this metaphor of value outside in is that's where I think HR can move forward. And when I look at the old books, the Drucker, the Warren Bennis, the Rentschler Lickert, all these great books, none of them talk about that. They don't talk about that. That isn't. So we talk about participative management, Mayo, the Hawthorne studies. We talk about inclusivity. And so I read the books on employee engagement. I read the books on inclusivity. How many pages are dedicated to customers, to investors? Almost none. And that's where the best is yet ahead. If we can, with your guidance and help by people like you, if we can get our HR people just putting on the hat of saying, what can I do to get a customer to have a better experience with the firm, to get an investor to have an experience, to get a community? And when I can begin to leverage that, it changes the world I live in. Final caveat in that theme. This is just, you say, what's on my mind today? This is it. HR is not about the humans inside. It's the stakeholders. And so when I'm in HR and you're a 20, 30-year-old, you're saying, I'm going to give a leadership development program agenda. I'm going to pitch leadership. I'm going to do talent acquisition. I'm going to do employee compensation. You go to the executive team with your PowerPoint and you're starting in the wrong place. I love practicality. When I go to the executive team to talk about culture, agility, hybrid work, whatever the policy is, my first few PowerPoints should not be anything to do with HR. Here's the customers of this group. Here's where they're buying and why they're buying. I am here today to change that criteria and to get them to buy more. Here's how we get investors. Here's how we show profit. Here's how we get debt or equity. I am here to change that. And people will look at us and go, well, I thought you were from HR. And say, I am. And the way we hire people will get customers to be more likely to buy from us. The way we hire people will get investors to be more confident. I've rambled and I'm really sorry, but that's the concrete thing. We change our conversation.
Exactly.
It's not about HR.
Yeah, I think you're broadening the conversation. We as HR leaders have an opportunity to help what I think is the fundamental assumption that kind of underlying what you're talking about here, Dave, is that we are short-term thinking. And most organizations are short-term, quarter-by-quarter driven. And so when leaders are making decisions in short-term, well, we're going to cut the workforce. We're not going to invest in training. We're not going to invest in helping our customer support. We're going to hit our numbers for the next quarter, maybe the next year. It's going to hit actually the long-term. And so HR leaders have to come in and say, from a business perspective, think long-term shareholder value. And I think when you look at Amazon, so successful because Jeff Bezos said, this quarter's results were the direct result of 2 years ago's investment. And no one ever talks about that. And so HR leaders, we have to help our leaders think broader and bigger
It's great.
And start to play this out. It's a very short-term driven world, but I think your perspective would change conversations, and it does reposition HR leaders as business leaders that are thinking about the future and helping people do things differently. So I love it.
I love it. I mean, a good HR person, there was a thing on LinkedIn, and I play in LinkedIn quite a bit. You mentioned I actually do respond to comments. I spend an hour or two a day, and I find it delightful. In fact, I just had a discussion with a publisher, and she said, would you edit this new book? And I said, I have a lot of LinkedIn followers. I get a lot of feedback every week. And I said, how many books did you sell on the last book we did? And she said, we sold 487. And I said, no, I'm not going to edit another book. No offense, but, and I shouldn't make fun, I'm not going to name the book or the editor, but no, that's not where I want to play. But the goal is, how do you do things that will create value for the next generation? And I know that's your passion. That's your passion. Think out ahead. And AI is an incredibly dangerous, seductive tool. Because AI says, I did a session yesterday with a large meatpacking company, and they said, we need to know the management skills of a plant manager in a meatpacking company. So we go on AI, we've learned how to ask the question, so what are the skills of a manager in a meatpacking company in, pick a country, in Brazil? And it gives me an answer. And she said, that's what we're going to do. And I said, how many of your competitors did that same exercise last week? Every one of them. Every one of them. That's variance. That's the 3-3-3-3. If you're going to win, look at AI, and then you've got to go the next step. You've got to get that human imagination to say, we're going to do something different. We're going to do something different. And AI, I get scared, creates a homogeneity of what everybody else is trying to do. It doesn't differentiate. That's where I hope we get the next best HR people.
I think it's really interesting. Also, the challenge with AI, at least where we're at today, the output is probably 60-70% right. Now, I don't mean hallucinations. I just mean that if you're an expert in the area, and I've used AI a lot, and trying to have it do my work, if you will, in consulting or other areas, and that's kind of right. That's a good start. Thank you. This is like it's like an intern or somebody's first couple of years of career that does a good start, and it gets me going. But then I go, you know, you got to do this. You got to do this, right? So it's a great tool. But if we start to lose our critical thinking capabilities and we don't understand how to make a product or how things are built in a business, you are really robbing yourself of a career, I think, and create what I call career capital that you need actually be able to do something when you get to your 40s or 50s or whatever that is, because you don't know how things work and how to build and take a blank sheet of paper and put something on it. That is the challenge with AI.
I totally love it. Again, I love anecdotes because they capture our daughter's a professor of sociology. 2 years ago when ChatGPT got popular, she said, Dad, I'm out of work. My students are going to do no papers. They're going to do a ChatGPT paper on demographics in Switzerland, whatever it is. So I thought, oh, that can't be true. So I did what you probably did. I went on AI. I said, write about the future of HR in 300 words. Bingo, it came out. I called our daughter back and I said, I'm out of work, because it really looks good. And then I read it again and I had the epiphany you had. Everything it said with, well, this is Peter Capelli. This is Linda Gratton. This is JP. It summarized what had been done, but it wasn't the future. She called me back a few days later. She said, now I have people or students turn in two papers. What's the AI paper and what's your paper? Because if you use AI, I love it. It's an assistant, but it will summarize. Now give me that paper, and every student in the class is going to give me the same paper. Now show me yours. And I just think that's where the human creativity will hopefully stand out.
My podcast guest next week is actually Bob Johansson. His writing team for Leaders Make the Future Part 3. Read that book. It's a great book, Dave. It's one of the most practical visions of where it could go that I've seen so far. It's actually really cool. I think you'd enjoy it. But
tell me the name again.
Leaders Make the Future by Bob Johansson, who's part of the Institute for the Future.
Institute of the Future out in California.
Yeah, exactly.
I have followed his work for 20 years.
Yeah, you know Bob Johansson.
He has place and time, same place, same time, and different place, different time. I mean, he was doing hybrid work before anybody could spell hybrid. He's an example. If I'm going to get into the hybrid work debate, I should go read some of that Institute of the Future early work, because it was really good. Different place, different time. That's called hybrid. How do you manage in that setting? Anyway, that's a model of his that I've always enjoyed. I haven't read his current work.
And I think what's so great, there's so many great voices but it requires you to go do the homework like we talked about, to be curious, to read these books, to put the time in. And read it, listen to a podcast. And if it hits you, then go find these books. I mean, you've mentioned multiple books today that are amazing.
Actually, what I've learned, JP, you've done this, podcast. I love to follow people who really are committed to learning. And we've listed some. Bob Johansson, Bob Eichinger, Jeff Pfeffer, Ed Lawler. And people say, what book have you read? And I say, I don't read books. I read people. Because if you take Jeff Pfeffer at Stanford, he's written 15 books. And it's fun to see the evolution of his view of influence and power and how it works. And it's fun to see Institute of the Future. I need to read the latest work. It's fun to see Bob Eichinger move from the Pepsi days of high performers into the different evolution. And when you find these folks who have that passion for learning and growing, I love to see the evolution, because some people write a great book and then you read their second book and you go, I read that. Then they read the third book and you go, I read that twice. And I hope people will look. I have a group of, I call them idea mentors, who just continually seem to be fresh of ideas. And they're fun to find. They're not easy to find. And I'm sure you've had that with your podcast.
Absolutely. Well, that's part of it. You're part talent scout as a podcast host. You have to be curious as the key factor. But I love your idea of reading people, following people, and listening to them. Is there anybody, Dave, from your perspective, who's kind of the future of HR thought leadership? I mean, to be honest, I've had conversations with Mark Efron, a few others. We say, who's the next Dave Ulrich? And we're like, well, I don't know if that's possible, but there's some great voices coming out.
Let me tell you who I am, and I'm going to answer that, and it may not be next. Our son decided to make a mistake, perhaps, but to follow into the career that I'm in. And he said, Dad, where do I study? And I said, go study with Pat Wright at South Carolina. Why? Because he'll train you in ways that I can't. And I think Pat, now he's not next generation because he's a little older, but Pat's continuing to reinvent. He has a succession institute or a center. He's doing new work. He keeps fresh. He's also got great values. He's willing to share. Our son said, Dad, that was a good idea. Where do you go for the next? And I keep looking. And it's really tricky because what we're seeing is bifurcation. In the academic thought leader world, the route to tenure and promotion is less and less and narrower and narrower. You got to do a lot of statistics about very few things. The route to application is variant and broader. And so having somebody who can play in both of those spaces gets really tough. Pat Wright is very good. Mark Huseford is very good. But there, when you find that next generation person in their 20s and 30s, let me know, because they're going to have a tough career. Let me tell you, I don't have tenure. Why don't you have tenure? Because you did consulting. But one of my mentors said to me, Dave, if you'd have taken all the consulting out of your resume, you'd have tenure. But because you consulted, you were seen as tainted. Some of my faculty friends at universities get tenure and then they come and say, well, now I want to go do what you do, which means make too much money for not doing anything. And I say, what do you have to say? Well, I've done statistics. Let me share with you my regressions. Executives don't care about regressions. They want to know how to think and how to solve problems. And I say to them, get on the road 100 nights a year and then let's talk. Well, I don't want to do that. I just want to get paid a lot. And I'm being really candid. You ask for candor. I'm being really candid. I get cynical about that. There's a price to do what you've done. There's a price to do what those thought leaders do. Pat is on my short list.
Pat's great. Pat's amazing. Has not been the podcast, but we had Kevin Cox and Anthony Nyberg from the Center for Executive Succession.
Amen to amen. But Kevin Cox is phenomenal. He's been at American Express at GE. And so is Anthony. I mean, he comes out of Wisconsin. Great, he and great team.
And I know. So, but let me put a point on this, because I don't think a lot of people know this, Dave. And I just recently found this out. In the academic institutions where you want to get tenure, it is punished in some ways to write a book and be commercial. And I was shocked, because I think the academia is out of touch. We want those ideas to get to the real world, and we want those books to be written. We do not want to go try to read a massive 500-page article or, you know, something written in academic literature. And so it's a real sad disconnect that I wish was tighter. So honestly, you made the right choice. We're happy with what you did. I would not worry about tenure. You have tenure with us forever in the HR organization, and that means a lot. Last question for you.
Our son got tenure, by the way, because he studied with
Pat. Oh, he did. That's amazing.
He did, and he's a researcher. He really loves that. Anyway, so I don't disagree. I think that boundary between academia and practice needs to be bridged, and we're seeing it. Management Business Review, new journals, we're seeing it, but some of the institutions don't yet incent for it. Hopefully it comes. There are people out there doing this kind of work.
Now, normally I ask my famous question around what's the future of HR in the next 5 to 10 years? I've asked you that before. That's episode 25. Go listen to that first conversation with Dave. I want to ask you a little bit more. You're speaking at Elevate 2025, and we're so grateful for that. And your presentation is titled, The Next Agenda for HR or Human Resources. What so what, now what? Can you give us a short preview of what you'll be talking about in that session?
Six words. Deliver stakeholder value, and we talked about it. deliver value. I love value to all stakeholders, employees, no question, but also customers, investors. Deliver stakeholder value through human capability. I picked up this metaphor of human capability at Elevate. It will be interesting to see. I may do the test. I was at a Horizons conference. I was at World Federation. This week, I was at a session in Colorado. The Singapore Human World HR Congress had 29 sessions in 2 days. Horizons had 39. In Colorado, in 1 day, they had 16. You leave those sessions and you go, I've got 16 things I'm going to go do. Well, that's just stupid. You're not going to do it. In Singapore, you've got 29 sessions. You got 39. I think we need what I'm calling human capability. We need a taxonomy. We need to organize complexity into simplicity and to say, of all those things you're going to hear at Elevate, I'm going to suggest there's four. I'm going to sit down, deliver stakeholder value. I'm going to help customers have a better experience so they'll buy more product. Investors have a better experience so they'll invest in our company. Communities have reputation with four things. Better talent. That's it. Anything related to people. Competence, skills. By the way, that's one of those examples. We talk about the great skill movement. And I go, we've called that competence before. That's Eichinger's work, actually. So I'm going to give you talent. Number two, I'm going to give you a great organization. That's culture. And our research shows that the team outperforms the individual. We've got tons of research on that. You play with people, you win with teams. Number three, I'm going to give you great leadership at every level. And number four, a great HR function. So the World Federation of HR, 29 sessions, there's four takeaways. I'm going to build better talent, leadership, organization, and HR. That's human, that's talent. Capability is organization. At Elevate, you're going to hear a lot of sessions. And they're amazing presenters. I've seen the schedule and thank you, honor me by letting me join. If you're listening to that session, I hope you attend. My first question I'd ask you is, who's the stakeholder you're trying to create value for? A, the employee, no question. Who else? The executive team, so they can develop strategy, their people, the board, so they can anticipate future, customers, investors, government. Who are you trying to create value for as a human being? Next three words, through human capability. What will you do in your talent efforts? For example, involve customers in designing training. In talent acquisition, let the customers set the criteria. Leadership. We've done a lot of work to say your leadership competence model should reflect your firm brand. IQ test of zero. Well, we're promising customers A, B, and C. That's our brand. We're doing leadership training X, Y, and Z. Well, that's stupid. Make sure that our talent, leadership, and organization is aligned against the value creation. And I hope people will walk away from Elevate with a couple of ideas in each of those categories. And they're going to be different. What matters for one company may not matter for the other. Six words, deliver stakeholder value through human capability.
Dave, this has been an incredible conversation. Thank you for being so candid, for telling us a little more about who you are and how you became Dave. All I have to say is that the best is yet to come. And I'm so grateful that you were here.
Thank you, Jim. Best from you. By the way, I'm going to give you the last line. I love simplicity. My PhD is in taxonomy and math, but it's not math. The test of a great leader. Do you leave the experience with her or with him feeling better or worse about yourself? Let me say that again. We can do all the statistics. We can do 360s. We can do all the training. How often do you leave an experience? And JP, I'm leaving this experience feeling better about myself. Thank you. That's the test of a leader.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Dave for sharing his personal journey and the experiences and values that have shaped his career. We are all grateful for your many contributions to the field and your generosity. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe, share our podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave us a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us to grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Marsha Avedon. Marsha is a three-time CHRO and most recently held the title Executive Vice President and Chief Human Resources Officer, Marketing and Communications Officer at Trane Technologies. She currently serves as a corporate board director and advisor for several organizations and is a sought-after executive coach, consultant, and speaker with deep expertise in large-scale transformation. In my conversation with Marsha, we discuss her advice to new CHROs on how to work with boards, and the key to driving organizational transformations. This is a great conversation with one of the best in our field, and you will not want to miss it. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.